My name is Sergeant Christopher Sean Goldsmith. I'm from Belmore, a town in Long Island, New York, 20 minutes out of Manhattan. I could see the smoke when the towers fell on September 11th. On September 12th, I remember standing up in a pizza restaurant and telling everyone about how I wanted to kill everyone in the Middle East, how the Middle East should be turned into a glass plate by nuclear weapons, because that's what I believed. That's what the media had trained me to believe. I joined the Army to kill people. I signed up as a forward observer. My job was to go out and basically annihilate the enemy when we received contact. I was in control. I was authorized to use mortars, artillery. That's what I was trained for. MLRS, multiple launch rocket systems, capable of destroying a grid square, which is 1,000 meters by 1,000 meters. A lot bigger than a city block. I was 19 years old when I was deployed to Iraq. And I spent the first 8 months in Sadr City, which is what everybody who has been in Baghdad considers the slums of Iraq. It's a place that has been neglected not only by Saddam Hussein, but is horribly neglected by America right now. The people there hate us, and the reason why is because when we went there, we promised them freedom and we promised them help. We promised to get them clean water, to get them food, to get them jobs. But all that I saw over there now, all that I saw over there in 2005 and all that there is now is 2 to 4 hours of electricity a day, randomly. Sewage that leaks into their fresh water system, if you want to call it fresh. A water treatment plant, which hasn't been finished. It was barely even worked on the entire year that I was set in Iraq. I never personally saw any contractors of any country working on that water treatment plant outside Sadr City in 2005. After going to Iraq, I quickly learned that it wasn't at all like I thought it was going to be. The people of Iraq were not grateful for us liberating them. They were angry because we were oppressing them. We gave them a curfew and told them that if they came out at night, they'd be arrested, sometimes physically abused. They were often harassed. And these would be people who were driving their pregnant wife to the hospital. They'd be rushing them to the hospital, and we would stop them and search their car, regardless of the fact that their wife was in labor. That happened on multiple occasions. That wasn't a one-time occurrence. That wasn't just my platoon. That wasn't just my company. That was my entire battalion all throughout Sadr City, and I'm sure it happened throughout the rest of Iraq. Imagine living in a place where it gets up to 150 degrees. You don't want to go out during the day. You want to stay in the shade. And at night, American soldiers are rolling around your streets telling you that you can't go outside and you can't talk to your friends, you can't enjoy yourself. You can't gather outside the coffee house or the chai shop because if you go out past dark, you're committing a crime. So essentially, during the summer months, Sadr City was a prison. 3.2 million people in Sadr City were prisoners of war. I was a great soldier once upon a time, and now I stand here to fight for my brothers more than I ever could while I wore a uniform. I'd like you to play the first video, please. What you see here is civilian Iraqis exhuming bodies of murdered and tortured Iraqis. We don't know why they were killed. We weren't really trying very hard to find out. We found over a dozen bodies that day. And my job, because we weren't authorized artillery, became the intel reporter. So I was forced to take pictures of these dead bodies. I was told for the sake of identity, so that we could try to identify them. But there was no identification process. I never went around with those pictures printed up to the police stations to post them and see if we could find out who they were. You'll see me in a couple seconds standing with another soldier who's on top of the pickup truck, lip right there, lifting up the faces of the Iraqi bodies to take pictures of them. All these pictures were taken for is trophies of war for people who didn't have to experience that death. People made videos to send home to their friends and family to brag, to say this is what happens to Iraqis and this is what the war looks like, and it's cool. When people ask me, hey man, you want to go see Saw 4 or whatever's out? I tell them no, because this is what I see when I watch those movies, and I can't bear to be reminded of that. This is what we nicknamed the Faces of Death. And it was a joke while I was over there. But while I was taking those pictures, I never looked directly at the bodies. What I did was I held the camera out in front of me. I had a digital camera. I held it out in front of me, and I looked at the 2.5-inch screen. And I flashed that photo. And as that flash went off, that image was burned into my mind. Every one of these pictures is burned into my mind. I remember I could draw them to the T. You'll see an image of a man having his face lifted up and his coagulated blood falling out of his nose. That coagulated blood slinged off his body, off his face, onto my shoe. And that was the most repulsed I had ever been. There were flies. It was May 15th, 2005. Very hot, uncomfortable, miserable day. I'll never forget it. There were flies landing on the corpses. And the flies are there, regardless of death, they're just looking for moisture. And they would land on my lips. They would land on my eyes. They would crawl into my nose. I felt so violated and emotionally raped to have to be put through this. And then the intelligence that I gathered was not used to help the Iraqis. It was used to build morale. To say that killing is right, death is right, dead Iraqis is a great thing. And that's wrong. That's the faces of death right there. These are the images that are burned into my mind that I'm reminded of when I play video games or walk into a movie that I shouldn't have seen. This is somebody's brother. This is somebody's husband. This is somebody's son. This is somebody's cousin. And the only reason that we're desensitized to it is because they're not white. They're not American soldiers. That right there is the man who bled on my foot. That right there, I specifically asked my command, and it was radioed up. I said, this man is missing his face. There is no skin left on his head. And they said, take the picture anyway. Not to identify him. Whoever was on the other end of the radio just wanted to see the picture. And now, because of that person, I'm left with that image. I'd like to tell you exactly what happened that day. Yeah, what you heard was true. Well, what they left out is that I was standing in a three-man position by a truck, a Humvee, in an alleyway with my platoon sergeant. My platoon sergeant claimed that he saw an insurgent and fired upon that man. He was wearing all black, and it is unknown if he got hit, if he was killed, wounded. And because of that, because of the highest enlisted ranking man in my unit or in my platoon was able to fire his weapon, I knew that it was game on and that I could get away with anything. There was a little boy on an alleyway to my left, on top of a building, a little boy who hated American soldiers, and he was holding up a stick as if to mock having an AK-47, and he was pointing it at me, pretending to shoot. I trained my weapon on him. I positively identified my target. I trained my weapon on him. and thought for a couple minutes. I hate these Iraqis. I hate these kids who throw rocks and bricks at me. This is my chance. I can kill this kid just to take one out of the couple million of them out. It took me a lot of thinking to not pull that trigger that day. I could have killed a 6-year-old boy. I could have killed someone's son.